is AI in crisis? And we've got four panel members entering the session, and I will give a few words after the other four panel members have given some short presentations. Each member of the panel will give a short presentation for 5 minutes on their views of whether or not the field's in crisis. And then after that, we will have a sort of an open discussion involving people from the audience as well as the panel members. So I'd like to ask Ronan Riley, who's the chair of the next AI conference, AICS conference.
Oh, that's still in discussion.
That's still in discussion. The next proposed chair for the AICS conference in University College Dublin for next year.
I think I don't generally believe there's a crisis in AI. I mean, I was probably when Paul circulated his call for papers, I think the general response was that perhaps the word crisis is not appropriate. I think in the last few years, in the last maybe 5 years, my view how AI will be achieved, how we will develop artificial intelligence systems, I think my view is different from what it was earlier. And I think there's some interesting research trends which are suggesting, at least from my personal view, where we will see AI emerging. It's a confluence of a number of these research trends that I think lead us to some breakthroughs. I won't say when, but I think you have a sense that you're moving along a road that looks a lot more promising than the road that you were following earlier. So these, I'm going to highlight maybe three research trends. I think one that came out strongly in the AI conference, and I think it was in the previous paper as well, there was hints of it, even though that was about vision. So the sense in which integrationism seems to be playing an important role in the development of complex systems. The idea that we, and I think the talk yesterday by Walter and Hahn was, it seems to me, to capture the strength of adopting an integrated approach to solving hard problems. We won't develop artificially intelligent systems by first working on one module so it produces a perfect output, having that output then passed on to another module and so on. We must have a very tightly integrated, the modules must be very tightly integrated. And the whole process of integration presents problems, and we are now just starting to tackle those problems. And my feeling is that's the way we have to go to achieve significant breakthrough in artificial intelligence. And I think if we had looked a bit earlier, if we had paid more attention to cognitive science and to perhaps the neuroscience literature, we would possibly have anticipated that this is what we have to do. There's the brain is structured in a modular way, but these modules interconnect in a very intimate way. And that interconnection seems to be the key to our intelligence, and it will be key, I think, to an artificial intelligence. I think the paradigm which looks most promising, I'm trying to think about a label for it, but situated robotics is probably the best label. This looks to be a very promising paradigm for developing artificially intelligent systems. It obviously requires an integrated approach. I think we will get intelligent systems if these systems have effectors and transducers and act upon their environment and process information from the environment. And I believe that that AI systems, successful AI systems, will arise from this paradigm. I think, surprisingly, or not surprisingly, given my background, I'm basically a psychologist by training, so this is a bias, I guess, but I think that there is going to be some very important developments in cognitive neuroscience, which will feed into this style of artificial intelligence. Up until now, the study of how the brain functions has been very, very crude. We don't have instruments or tools for exploring brain function in a very precise way. But there are some developments on the horizon. MEG is one of them, it's microencephalography. And it's different from, you might be already familiar with PET scanning and MRI scanning. Microencephalography is actually the measurement of those minute currents that are created when activation is transmitted relaxes in the brain. And it has an interesting property. First of all, it's non-intrusive, so we can measure the brain activity in a very non-intrusive way by looking at the magnetic fields that are created by these microscopic currents. But the other side of that coin is you can not just read brain activity, but you can write, if you like, brain activity with many. The potential for taking a magnetic field and using it to create currents in different parts of the brain. And it's in Colombia they're exploring this very possibility. And it seems this is going to be a very promising tool for exploring the functional behavior of the brain, which will, I think, yield results which are going to feed into cognitive theories and ultimately into artificial intelligence. So, to reprise, I think there's what Paul may have detected as a crisis is actually something, I hate to use the word paradigm shift, but it's something of a shift in the approach that we're going to take. And I think that's what maybe I have been alluding to in his title. And I think these are the elements of that shift. I'm now more confident than I was, say, 5 years ago, that AI is going to yield some interesting intelligence systems in maybe the next 5 years.
Thank you. I'd like to ask James Crowley to write an
interview. I think it's useful to put things in historical perspective, and I'll use that second. I was at Carnegie Mellon from 1975 to 1985, at the time when expert systems became hot. And if we think about what was going on, in the 1960s, there was some interesting early work in planning and chess and things. And suddenly IBM came along and they were afraid they were going to lose their sales. So they said, computers cannot be intelligent. Computers cannot be intelligent. And they got rid of their AI department. This was in the 60s. And I remember when I was a student, I wanted to study AI. And this was the early 70s. And they said, no, that's not a science. There's nothing there. You can't do it. And there were only three places I could go to, Carnegie Mellon, MIT, or Stanford, had active research. And then suddenly, Meissen, 1978, and R1, and OPS5, and suddenly there were these things called expert systems that were paying for themselves. And suddenly it became a very hot discipline, and AAAI exploded as a conference, and all sorts of funding money came in, particular for expert systems, but in general for AI, and it was heaven. But it was an overreaction. And I remember there was talk of AI winter coming, if we didn't start producing some results. Well, it came. But it's just a correction. In fact, the historical perspectives are much longer. And we need to look at other scientific disciplines to really understand. There is this model called the S-curve of how technology develops. And in order to talk about technology development, you first have to talk about performance measurements. So unless you've got performance measurements, it's fuzzy, speculative. So by any particular measure of performance, technology tends to grow as a cumulative Gaussian. And this makes sense, because in fact what's happening is you're composing lots of little cumulative Gaussians, and when you convolve the Gaussians with Gaussians, you get more Gaussians. And so what happens in any technology is initially there's an idea, an innovation, but it's very hard to put it into application, and you have to attract resources to start to grow. As it attracts resources, you start down a learning curve and you start to learn things, and you start to see performance grow. Now, as it starts to grow, it attracts more resources, it feeds on itself exponentially, and you start to get a nice growth, but eventually you saturate the potential of the idea. Then, once it's saturated, other ideas come along. And when you think about that curve, what does research funding do to it? Well, one of the things you can do by pouring a lot of money into a problem is compress the curve. And in some cases, basic research money can actually shift the point where the curve starts. But you can play with this S-curve, but you're stuck with it. Things do that. This is the nature of the universe. The time scales involved in major technologies tend to be very long. And I would cite a few examples just to put some perspective. Electricity, which was one of those grand challenge things that people looked for all through the 19th century. Amper was in the 1820s. Edison in the 1870s, 50 years later, when we finally had working dynamos and generators and we could think about replacing gas light with electric light. And it was very controversial. Timescales were quite long. Aviation, that's one of my favorites. There were aviation laboratories in the 1870s. Langley in particular had one. And I'm sure there were people at the time saying, men will never fly. Heavier than air, things will never fly. The Wright brothers came around in the 1900s, and we started to see commercial airlines in the 1920s, and right now 747s and Airbuses are completely revolutionizing the entire world because people are mixing very easily. It's now easy to travel anywhere. Bell Dream was in 1870, actually feeding on communications before that, but it was 50 years before telephones became widely used. We forget that because we take for granted telephones are there, and that maybe they happened like that. They didn't. It was 50 years from the time it was invented to the time it was commonly in houses. And communications in general. My dates might be off by a decade or so, but I think Morse was doing his work stuff in the 1840s. Bell in the 1870s, getting voices over lines. Marconi in the 1900s, proving that radio could work. I mean, it was in Maxwell's equations, so we knew that in theory it should work. We knew how to do it. And then Shannon coming along in the 1840s. And 1940s, and Kotelnikov in Russia at the same time, and showing us theoretically what's really going on. So, time scale is 50 to 100 years for new technologies. So I think we're doing fine. We're on track. It's coming. We need some things. I think I would have loved it when McCarthy went to stay here, because I think he puts too much emphasis on symbolic reasoning. I think that's just one piece of the puzzle. It's an interesting piece. Like I tell my students, logic is to reasoning what mathematics is to engineering. It's a language we use for describing systems. Wouldn't want to try and build everything in Prolog. We make very good use in our group, by the way, of Lisp as the high-level control, running procedures written in C and C++. I guess if we had other languages, we would use them, but you need the multiple levels. We need progress, fundamental progress in a number of domains. I can say that vision right now is going through a paradigm shift, and I won't hesitate because it is. It's an early paradigm shift, so it's not quite easy. We have some paradigms. Many of them haven't worked out, and we're seeing a shift right now to appearance-based methods and methods based on signal system, away from things based on structure that we had previously. But in order to make progress in any domain, we've got to have performance measurements, we've got to have reproducible experiments, and we need the solid mathematical foundation. So we'll get there.
Professor Okada from Kyushu Island in Japan.
That one's your side of the world.
I'd like to make clear my position through 6 question answering. Question 1. Is AI in crisis? Why in crisis? AI goes ahead slowly and steadily. Question 2. Are there breakthroughs in near future? Let's divide all things into algorithm and data. Okay. In the field of algorithm, there may be some breakthroughs in near future. But data, in particular, knowledge data, I am very much suspicious. Data collection, in particular, knowledge data collection is far behind algorithm development. Okay. Question 3. How collect knowledge data at human level? At the moment, machine-assisted handicraft is necessary, for instance, to make big semantic dictionary for machine translation. They are not possible to be done by automatic language system. We have to make such data by handicraft at the moment. Of course, in future, machine learning will be possible. So, how many data we need at human level? Here are two examples. Primitive events in image processing, according to common sense, I think 1200. Even rules of common sense. For instance, if the sun sets, it gets dark. This is a common sense. If one works hard, one gets higher salary. This is another piece of common sense. So how many less than 100,000 we have? Are the concepts or rules enough as knowledge data? No. Episodic data, including many, many inferences in everyday life, are inevitable. If we have one in our brain, then we should at least 10 instances to make the concept should be surrounded by the concept. 10 instances. Finally, when do intelligent agents come close to human level, more than 100 years later, from the point of data collection, knowledge collection? Thank you.
Professor Jane from...
Well, I was told this morning that I should be on the panel, so I don't have a transparency. And I'm also, I think, an outsider of the traditional terms of AI. My background started in kind of like based disciplines and so on. So perhaps I should give a few comments. So before we talk about is AI in crisis, we should sort of say, what is AI? I think Akaki said yesterday that the goal is to develop human level intelligent tasks. But what are some of these intelligent tasks? Well, computer vision is one of the intelligent tasks, ability to recognize things. Speech understanding is an intelligent task. But what has happened is that most of the people who work in these domains have sort of broke away from AI. And if you go to a traditional AI conference, you don't see a lot of work being reported on speech understanding or computer vision and things like that. And those are some of the successful systems. And so I remember 20 years ago, it used to be 30 years ago when I was a graduate student, that what work is pattern recognition and what is work AI? And I think that is the truth. And sometimes people in AI do not give credit to what actually works. And that's not just a criticism of AI, but even for computer vision conferences. If you have a working system, it probably will not be accepted in a prestigious computer vision conference, because there is more emphasis on formalism and symbolism and representation and so on.
You might get a poster.
You might get a poster.
In an application section.
So just to, I'm not trying to pick on the speaker about today's presentation this morning, but it reminded me of the work 30 years ago, template matching correlation. That was one of the first approaches for doing pattern matching. But people in vision gave it up. I mean, they didn't pay much attention to it, but it's coming back. Well, partly it's coming back because you can do real-time recognition. And 30 years ago, we were not able to do that. But template matching is no longer a dirty word now. Like, if you restrict domain, it is one of the most efficient techniques. Isolated. Now, it is one of the oldest methods in pattern recognition, principal complement analysis. In fact, in the early, one of the early books on investigation processing, people talk about how the love transform. But again, when people adopt it, they don't sort of refer to the classical literature on it. And they don't also emphasize what are the limitations of principal component analysis, because after all, it's all based on covariance matrix. And there are certain limitations about capturing the data description in terms of second order statistics. Okay. And so the reason why eigenspaces work is because if you restrict the domain, control the lighting, and make sure the background is relatively homogeneous, but in the general setting, it will not work. Bayesian decision making. Again, people are coming back to the Bayes decision making, especially in terms of integration, because Bayesian methods are still some of the most powerful methods of combining prior information with the observation. I can go on, and then I can give you two other things. For example, the work which went on in expert system and rule learning. A lot of that work was essentially early work in pattern recognition related to decision fields, string classifiers. All right. I mean, the ID3 system, just to give you an instance of that, was well known in pattern recognition from the point of view of tree classifiers using mutual information and so on. So I think in order for AI to continue to make progress, I think it has to accept that that the domains where successful systems have appeared is because, you know, you pay attention to data collection, maybe sensors, you pay attention to the processing of data, which traditionally has been neglected in the AI community. And then the representation and matching, which are important issues, have to be built in with the data collection and feature extraction.
Thank you very much. I'll just do a short few words about some things, and then I think we can throw it open and have some points of view from the audience and interaction with the panel as well. Okay, so some people might have noticed on the program committee for the AI97 meeting, there was actually a person called Murphy. And Murphy is actually a robot at the University of Sheffield. And here's a picture of Murphy right here. He's a nomad robot from California. And this is Professor Sharkey here, Dol Sharkey, and one of his research assistants, John Leary. And Murphy's arm is on the table here, not on him. And he communicates with his arm through a radio link. And this is an area which a number of people have mentioned. Ronan and Professor Von Hahn, James Crowley, John McCarthy last night at the banquet talked about robots being very important. And this is an area where I think we're seeing a lot of pull for integration of technologies, integration of speaking, where we speak to the robot, integration of vision, where the robot's moving in an environment, needs to see where it's going, and also has other sensors for doing things like sonar sensing and laser sensing even. So I think that's one type of innovation that we're seeing pushing the whole move towards integration. Another area we're seeing integration a lot is between traditional computing and mobile technologies. And that's going to become much more important in the future, where we've got robots or other types of computers in remote or distant environments, and we're going to be able to have to communicate with them. And here's just a brief slide from the Center for Personal Communication, where we've got an integration project integrating speech understanding and speech generation with vision processing. Here there's 2D plans or a 3D model on the workbench. At least one camera for interpreting what's on the workbench and the pointing of a user. A laser device for output for pointing and drawing route descriptions. Microphone arrays for doing sound source localization. So this is the type of thing that we're seeing a lot more. Integration of different modules, different types of information. I think we saw a lot of that mentioned during this meeting. The people who say that AI is a crisis, these are people like John Searle and the Dreyfus brothers and so on. I don't think AI is a crisis. I think we need to ask the question, what do we do next? And one of the things I think we need to do a lot more is integration.
rather than the Chinese room of John Searle, I've got here the Irish room. And the Irish room's got a leprechaun in it, Sean the leprechaun. And the leprechaun receives input coming into the room. But it isn't just language, like in the case of the Chinese room. It's language with other types of input for grounding the language, like, for example, simple icons in this case, but it could be video sequences, it could be sounds, it could be even tactile input coming in with the words so that the leprechaun can learn what words mean. In other words, grounding the language in other areas of perception input. I think we've seen that come up a number of times during this meeting as well. Another thing that I think is very important is monitoring intentions in vision, but also in language. I've done some work in the past on looking at intention sequences of people in natural language dialogue. These numbers here are people numbers. And we can see right away that person number 4, for example, is going 5 times from an information request to an explanation request. Person 4 is looping on explanation requests in a dialogue. Persons 1 and 7 are looping on instruction requests. In other words, monitoring the intentions of users at the dialogue interface or even the visual interface over time. I think that's going to be very important in the future. And building systems where we can model the dialogue interaction with the user over time and be able to build a system which enables us to build lots of applications of the types of dialogue interaction we want with the user. So, just to finish up, what am I saying? I'm saying that cognitive science and computer science are equal to IQ. And what is IQ? Well, obviously it's information, lots of different types of information, text, speech, visual information. And when I say information, I mean quantitative information. Theories of Shannon, we need to use those for this type of processing, and also qualitative theories of information like this one, where we're looking at the types of questions or the types of dialogue interaction in on the input. Integration is very important. We see that come out a number of times. Integrating the information. And also the intentions. Why are those users doing the things that we recognize them doing? What's the reason for that? Last slide. This is something else which is driving us towards integration, both of traditional multimedia and intelligent multimedia, the super information highway. Here we've got the lexicon in the language truck. We've got syntax and semantics. I put them in the same part of the truck. Some people would argue with that. And then pragmatics is over here. We can't even see how large that part of the truck is because people who cannot solve problems in here or in here put them into this part of the truck and say, that's pragmatics. So I think we can throw it open now. Anybody have any comments or?
I wanted to react to some things that James had said.
Okay.
Just to, if I might.
Okay.
There was a bit of an injustice done in the 1970s, 1980s, about the time when AI hit its fad stage, where there was a rejection of things rooted in pattern recognition and information theory. And I was a graduate student at the time and saw that happening. It was kind of strange to me because I had studied pattern recognition and knew the techniques, but I had to follow the gurus, who were all the symbolic reasoning people. And there was an injustice that was done. I think it's being repaired now.
I don't want to call it injustice. I just sometimes it's not unnatural with me. Like for example, now there's a big hype on the network, and I think over the last 5 years, attendance at major neural network conferences has dropped significantly, just like for AI conferences. And the same thing, they thought they had sort of a completely new paradigm of doing things, but in many ways they were really partitioning the teacher space.
Yep.
How they were doing it. different, but...
Right, right. So you might say what goes up comes down. And things come, easy go. And things grow too fast, they usually fall afterwards.
That's also happened in the speech NLP community. Things have gone to fashion that were years ago and they've come back again now. So that's quite common, I think. Patrick?
Yeah, forgive me for saying that I'm not reassured that there's no crisis when quite a number of computer scientists, all of whom have established major research projects over the past 20 years, tell me there's no crisis. Of course, there's not a crisis from the perspective of those of us sitting in here reading the papers. But stepping back and asking the big question, is integration really going to give us something new, going to bring it closer to intelligence? Or is this just another path for us to wander around in the wilderness? The fact that the vote went 5-0 here, I don't find.
First of all, as an academic researcher, nothing is a crisis. I mean, you know, you're free to pursue whatever research agenda you want, right? And so in that sense, you know.
Except when you can't get funding.
That's the issue. I mean, as a research student or as a professor, you know, you're free to pursue whatever
that right. I saw a crisis in computer vision recently when the European Commission backed out of funding basic research projects in computer vision. They haven't, but there was talk of it. Some people got up and said the computer vision doesn't work. There's no point pouring any more money into it. People are just playing with images in the laboratory. That's a crisis.
But integration is not the complete answer either. I mean, you know, what you integrate and how you integrate is also important. So you cannot just take raw data and integrate it in some way, ad hoc way, and expect it to work.
Mm-hmm. What I find interesting about the integration issue is that in the beginning people tried to do integrated AI. They tried to do everything together, vision and NLP and speech and robots all together. Shaky at Stanford, SRI. And then it got too difficult, so people often worked on different parts then. And also in different departments, you know, people did speech and language in computer science or linguistic departments. People would often did vision and engineering departments, sometimes psychology departments. It all got separated. But now we're seeing recently, maybe since 1994, of course some people worked on the integrated stuff all along anyway, it all coming together again. And it'll be interesting to see whether how long that lasts and if we get any major achievements by doing that. John's got...
Well, just a question by Professor Crowley's comment that mentioned the phrase earlier, AI winter. I mean, I was experienced it sort of in Britain in the early 70s. There was a thing called the Lickham Report came out around 1971-72, and it meant that a proposal, you couldn't even put the phrase pattern recognition in your proposal for about 2 or 3 years before the AI connotation. Are we sufficiently far up your technology curve? I mean, I think if we're well up that curve, we're probably not susceptible to fluctuations in opinions. And
I think we're still turning the corner, both in computer vision and robotics and AI in general. We're still turning the corner and in that beginning of exponential phase, and what's going to drive it are applications. When Philips starts putting large amounts of money into interactive kiosks that see and converse in natural language.
So the public wants these products. It's not scientific committee, so we're not susceptible to scientific committees anymore in DC
We certainly are.
Yeah.
We certainly are. And having participated in a few of them in Brussels, I can say that it wasn't too bad when the Lighthill Report came in England because it killed English AI, but it left American and other countries okay. Same thing happens in France, by the way, in other domains. But if it happens in Brussels, then it happens all over Europe, and then we have a problem.
I think that's all the same. I think that France, if the government in France decides they're going to go somewhere, that they usually keep going for a good deal longer than I think in the East.
It's like an enormous ship. It's extremely hard to turn, and it, it's a big tanker.
The technology, I mean, to what extent, I think some Professor Fajani said about the mathematics, the mathematics of information theory and of principles analysis are difficult. It seems easier, you know, if you pick up a book on knowledge-based systems, you may not find a solution or an integral whole thing. And if you are students seduced into, I mean, students are, I think mathematical capabilities are getting, are decreasing. Students who come to college are less able in mathematics. I mean, is there a view that, is there a shortage of good graduates who can do mathematics and just don't want to wave their arms?
You need better students. I have the opposite problem. My students have gone through 2 years of intense mathematical training. They're better at formulas than I am.
Yeah.
They don't have any intuition, but they're really strong in the math. But that's just a particularity of the French education system.
Yeah, but I mean, that's good for that's a good quality.
Well, it's not always a good quality, you know.
You can't learn maths. You can get intuition, but maybe
when
you get intuition,
maybe
you can't learn maths, really.
But I think it is true that typical computer science students is not very comfortable in continuous math, like differential equation and so on. I mean, a typical computer science curriculum only has the discrete math, and after they take the calculus in the first year or two, then the rest of their curriculum they won't use it. So Fourier transform and things like that, they feel extremely...
Certainly in the U.S.
I think that's a question to take up with your curriculum, because we had the students away from the real math with the club.
Curriculum committees are notoriously difficult to take up with.
Steve, I have a question mainly for the vision people here. If you go to a vision conference, how many of the people there would describe what they're doing as AI? Or they sort of, I suspect the percentage would be quite low, and they're sort of trying to distance themselves from what they perceive as a shift.
No, I don't think so.
Well, I think the people who would call themselves AI are those who are sort of probably more interested in, let's say, 3D versus 2D. And that's one of the distinctions sort of evolved in let's say, image processing community versus the computer vision community. Computer vision community typically were interested in, let's say, shape from shading as opposed to, let's say, document image analysis or image restoration or image enhancement. I would say that's a subtle distinction which is sort of gradually diminishing as people are sort of more interested in building complete systems.
It's diminishing as people are more interested in building complete systems. There was a time in the 1980s when people followed the Mar paradigm. So the AI component of vision, the one that was politically correct with respect to...
That's right. So basically, deriving 3D information from 2D images.
Right. And in fact, there's a rejection of that now because it has not provided stable solutions. And, I think it's almost a personal thing. Quite a few people in computer vision would consider that vision as an essential component of AI. They've got at vision because they want to understand intelligence.
Edwin? I have an annual question. Given I find it very hard to understand why AI should be in crisis in terms of the overall goals of the sector. One aspect that I have seen is very important. How do you see AI fitting into a university organization where there's a classification of subjects to be studied? If you have the chance to set up your own university framework, bearing in mind the multidisciplinary nature of the subject as you presented, particularly with integration, looking at students getting jobs in the whole sort of fabric of society, what would be your ideal arrangement for AI as a subject in a university setting? In other words, advice for new organizers. How do you see things now?
I'd be doing all the talking.
Yeah.
I had an answer to that. But.
Well, I think unfortunately I'm going to get several answers, probably four different answers. Yeah. I mean, my inclination would be that it would be very much allied with the biological and cognitive sciences, and less, I guess, and engineering for, you know. My view is basically that the route to intelligent systems is via robotics, so we need the engineers to build the robots, we need the biological sciences to understand how human intelligence systems work, and the cognitive sciences for a deeper understanding of human intelligence. So that's almost everybody, I guess.
Can I give a different answer based on the same idea? The route to intelligence is through building robotics and systems. So there's a very diverse set of basic disciplines that need to master. Certainly, expert systems and planning. And various forms of symbolic reasoning and a basic logic prologue is part of it. At the same time, I think cybernetics, control theory, you need at least some grounding in that. Pattern recognition is fundamental. Information theory is very important. Control theory in general, knowing about controls, both classical and modern, it's very important. Neurobiology is important. You've got to have a good grounding in cognitive science as well, and some of the cognitive science models. And so it's a very broad program, and it would be hard to integrate it into one master's.
And you put it all together, then you have a school artificial intelligence.
Yes.
So I think which department AI fits into depends on what the background of the people or what their
interests are. There's something in the tail of this question, which comes the following way. I mean, what you said, I would naturally expect you to say in a way. Now, after that, the idea is you've got to have existing disciplines for doing other things. How do they mesh into this? I mean, you can set up your AI brain. I mean, you can ideally set up all the courses that are required. And maybe you'd be able to partition it into different professions with this too wide a range for different types of people. People who can do maths, maybe do part of it and so on, but there's still a community that can do what you want. But then there's doctors and all sorts of other intermeshed requirements. The question was actually a nasty question, was how do you advise people trying to set up a structure in the university so people don't shoot each other when things like this are so important to get going?
Well, the structure has to be good, and that depends on the background of your faculty.
Sure.
You know, so really that's the answer. I mean, it depends on which type of AI faculty you hire. If they're logicians, then you sort of have a different grouping, as opposed to if you have robotics people, then you have a different grouping.
I think it's a very important distinction between what you're talking about and conventional academic distinction, in that artificial intelligence is almost a goal-directed description, since it describes what something is trying to do. If you think about the traditional departments like mathematics, what is the goal of mathematics or the goal of biology? So I think you're looking at decisions on a completely different level, and I don't think that you really want to just start having a department of goal. And you also want to have a department of...
We can find domains, though, that have similar characteristics. Think of aviation. And there are academic departments in aviation. And aviation calls on a very large number of disciplines, fluid mechanics, chemistry, structural, material science. I don't know that classically there are many aviation departments, but there are a few at some key universities that are multidisciplinary. Same thing for the Robotics Institute of Carnegie Mellon. Carnegie Mellon had a deliberate policy of multidisciplinary institutes, and the president of the university insisted that robotics be composed of people from mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, civil engineering, and arts. There were people from the art school, from architecture, and of course computer science, who were at the heart of the Robotics Institute. And it was that interdisciplinary aspect that made the institute the success that it was. And institute doesn't necessarily mean academic department. It's almost a matrix. Mm-hmm.
That's what I was trying to say, and thank you for making it much more clear.
And medicine might be another model as well. Another model. We have the goal of medicine is very much a goal-directed exercise, with, drawing on different disciplines.
Not just that, to the answer to the previous question, in our idea that we have a much program.
I mean, general scheme is sort of metric, academic content that way, and sort of vocational selection going across grain. I mean, that's an easy thing to write on paper.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The next phase is the difficult one, is how you define and cut up the territory, and that is mobile.
The big danger is that at a master's level, it's very hard to come in without any previous training. So I wanted to introduce control theory into our image vision robotic course. I think it's a scandal that robotics students would never study control theory. And my colleagues say, well, we're not going to teach control theory. We'll get the experts in the next department to teach it. And the experts say, well, we're already teaching it at the master's level. Send your student over to our master's program. And the students get over and they're gone. They're lost because they're competing with students who have already studied for 2 years.
Yeah.
I mean, my answer is a biased one. I do believe that successful AI will be cognitive science. And I think you'll see an increasing merger of the two areas. But I'm sure people here would disagree with me strongly.
I just want to say a word about my experience while I've been in Denmark at Aalborg University, and that is that there's loads and loads of AI going on in Denmark, everywhere in Denmark, and especially in the university that I'm at, there's loads of AI going on, vision, speech processing, speech generation, expert systems. But the Danes never use the word AI to describe what they're doing. And also, they've got loads of expert systems using Bayesian statistics modeling and doing decision taking. Their programs have even been used in the NASA space shuttle program. But they never call it AI, they never call it expert systems. They're extremely conservative about what they call what they're doing. And I found that very interesting.
What do they call it?
Well, they call it, for example, the expert system is called decision taking system, or it's called Bayesian statistics stochastic modeling system. The speech processing it's just called speech processing, speech synthesis, speech recognition. But you never see the word AI. Sometimes it's a matter of language, of what we use. What language do we use to describe what we're doing?
I mean, I come from an engineering background, and we tend to talk about that system rather than artificial intelligence. And I mean, going back to the analogy generally about the aviations, we finally got a good jet engine because all the individual parts were well together, so specialists in their jobs and personal aspirationists, poly IDM, were able to integrate. I think maybe with AI, the integration is going to clash, and they're going to go back to specialists and clash again until eventually it gets to a stage where we can engineer a proper system. I think, although it's merging again, it's probably going to clash and we're going to go away again. And it's going to happen a few times before we're finally to a well-engineered, adaptive system.
Jet engine, by the way, was invented by Frank Whittle in 1926 as a master's thesis. He spent 10 years spinning his wheel trying to build a working prototype with a shoestring budget. Henkel, a German aircraft manufacturer in 1938-39, independently got the idea, and with German organization, commissioned 9 separate designs, implemented them in parallel, and number 5 worked out. Or was it number 8? I think it's number 8 that worked out. And that's what they built their first jet aircraft on. And it was because somebody at a high level made a determined effort to build a working system.
That's the aspirational side. Then only the individual parts to develop.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got to build systems. We've got to build systems for the technology to advance.
I was going to say that we should really look in this direction that Jane has just been mentioning now, a more industrially oriented direction rather than the academic related discussion that we had a few minutes ago. I think that something which is very, very important is just the underlying infrastructure. Look at well now and the role that that plays in our work in different communities, quite clearly that's of extreme importance. Maybe in the near future, something like the Java-Logan language will be important for image processing, and that's something that John Campbell talked about recently. I think, therefore, the whole issue of crisis is completely and totally linked to to what one is attempting to do. So, for instance, portable and mobile telephony and communications plays a very big role in the coming years, that some of the issues discussed in this meeting will simultaneously be very important. Anyway, I'd like to just put one question to Jim Galley in particular, and that is in relation to what may, I think you find for you, Jim, that if Philips decides to turn in a certain direction, that will play a big role in our lives, and we really don't really care to play much of an influencing role relative to the decisions that they take. Well, thinking about Philips, thinking about similar companies in telecommunications, in consumer electronics, maybe even in robotics, especially in the European context, with regard to the European Computer Vision Network of Excellence, is there any way to bring some considerations and ideas to bear on such companies?
Sure, sure. We have an organization called the Policy Panel, and we have been, and we write survey reports about technology evolutions and opportunities, and we participate in meetings at the Commission and try and show them where a little bit of money can make a big difference. That's what we try to do. We don't always get listened to. The Commission does a lot of these kinds of meetings. And I know about Philips, for example, from one of the meetings where a woman from Philips came and presented to to us and to the commission the results of their two-year foresight study, where they had projected all sorts of possible products they could build in the markets. The network is, one of its goals is to try and organize that policy foresight activity. And I think it's important that governments, national and European, want to do that.
I just I detected in your question, Jim, that we have now, if you like, enough information from an academic point of view to go to market with products. And in response also to Jim, he talked about the development of radio communication, for example. You know, that we had the Maxwell equations from the last century, and it took so long then to produce radio communication systems. We don't have the Maxwell equations for intelligent systems yet. I mean, we're really not even off the floor on the S-curve. And I think, perhaps from the vision point of view, we can do interesting things with the market of products. But certainly, moving up, you know, at the level of what most people understand by artificially intelligent systems, we're not anywhere near that. Absolutely.
I don't think it's an either-or situation.
I like your idea, actually. But there really is need for very fundamental breakthroughs in direction.
Absolutely.
I think there is a crisis. There's no crisis in the subject because there's a problem to be solved in that matters, and people will work on that as long as the problem is solved. And I would be more worried if we solved all the problems, what would we do to work then? The crisis is one affecting by society, and we come back to funding, and the issue is raising. And I think the problem is the strong AI we power problem. And whenever we build an intelligent machine, the first thing Joe Public also says is, oh, it's not as good as a human being, and a deep blue can't play tennis or even tell me the time. So I think the problem with the AI term, the problem with intelligence is what most people, and hence the influence they have in their companies or in government or whatever, is that at the end of the day, they say, it's not strong AI. And so our danger is that because we use the term AI, people want strong AI. They then say, you haven't achieved it, you're failing. And it's really, we need to be making progress and showing that progress to people in intelligence, but not necessarily, we're not going to get strong intelligence tomorrow. Mm-hmm.
I think we should. Just very briefly.
Yeah, this is a quick one. You said we're not even on the floor of the S-curve. The question that I'd like to ask is, how do you know that we're not off the floor of the S-curve and that we are not off the floor of an S-curve and not instead not off the floor of a straight line? How do we know that we haven't been changing cloud systems for the past 50 years?
We might. You need performance measures. The way to know is to see improvement in performance. So you've got to define those benchmarks. And you've got to see them move. That's how you do.
I think we should finish off. I think maybe, Jim, did you want to say, I thought a nice way to finish off this session, maybe you said a few words about what is the grand challenge. Did you want to?
Well, I think people could read it in one of the newsletters.
I'll give you
background.
Not everybody here has got access to the newsletters.
The Commission held a workshop where they were looking for new things under the MR5 program. And some of us started kicking the ideas around, I think it happened over here or whatever, that what we need are some good grand challenges, some targets that are very difficult to achieve, maybe impossible, but that bring people together. And so I've issued a grand challenge. And fortunately, it's been taken up. There's even a news forum now. Devoted to the new successor to basic research, and that's one of the topics. And the challenge is human-level intelligence in the sense of bringing together speech, vision, natural language, learning, reasoning, to make systems that you can dialogue with that would do things for you. And I gave the case of a system which can control complex machinery, for example, your house, or a plant, a nuclear power plant, for example, or your car. Okay, and pick your car. You would like your car to be able to drive itself and to do what you need it to do and configure itself. And you would talk to it like you would talk to your mother or your wife or your child. I don't know, whichever you prefer. So the grand challenge is to make systems which integrate these technologies together and give us natural man-to-machine interaction using the modes that we use to interact with each other.
I think that's a good thing. So I think we should thank panel members. Thank you all for participating, and Philip, I'd like you're going would you like to tell me about the first thing of the root of the getting closer?
Two things. First of all, the idea of merging robots is, of course, possible with that property in the car park, right? And before then, there are some bridges there as well, which you can kind of fail out right here if you don't want to go off between now and then. Is that okay? And the tour, well, it will be back about, I guess, 7:30, something of that, around then this evening, we'll be back presumably to here, to the car park, right? So just in closing the meeting, I just want to thank one person in particular. Well, I do want to thank Ted as well, but I'm not going to give Ted a gift on the... We want to give Caroline just a little gift as a result of her heroic efforts over the past few days. So I think things have gone very well, and there have been other people in the infrastructure of the university too who have played a role that was very much appreciated. I'd like to thank you all for coming here, and keep in mind that the website will stay active in the sense, therefore, that it will be a point of contact so that you see, for instance, references, links for next year's event in the two directions, the AI and in the vision direction. So thank you all very much, and very good trip back home.
Thank you.